Part 3. Blood. Multicellularity, the evolutionary transition that made single-celled organisms organize themselves into many-celled beings, may have been inevitable, but it wasn't easy. Multicellular organisms needed to evolve specialized and separate organs to serve their many functions. Each such being had to evolve functional units, separated but connected, to handle its multifarious requirements: self-defense, self-recognition, the movement of signals through the body, digestion, metabolism, storage, waste disposal. Every organ in the body exemplifies these features. Cooperativity between cells and cellular specialization to achieve the function of the organ. But perhaps more than any cellular system, blood represents a model to describe how an entire system of cells achieves these functions. The constant circulation of blood works as the body's central highway to deliver oxygen and nutrients to all tissues. It ensures a coordinated response to injury. Platelets and clotting factors use the circulatory system to survey and navigate the body to respond to acute injury, and it enables a response to infection. White blood cells traffic through the same system of vessels to provide layer upon layer of defense against pathogens. Deciphering the biology of each of these systems has led, in turn, to the creation of new cellular medicines: blood transplantation, immune activation, and platelet modulation, among others. And so, from single cells, we now move to systems of multiple cells, to cooperation, defense, tolerance, and self-recognition, the hallmarks embodying the benefits and liabilities of multicellularity. The restless cell. Circles of blood. The cell is a nexus, a connection point between disciplines, methods, technologies, concepts, structures, and processes. Its importance to life and to the life sciences and beyond is because of this remarkable position as a nexus, and because of the cell's apparently inexhaustible potential to be found in such connective relationships. Maureen A. O'Malley, philosopher of microbiology, and Stefan Müller-Wille, science historian, 2010. There is much that is irresolute and restless about me. Rudolf Virchow, in a letter to his father, 1842. Consider where we are in our story. We began with the discovery of cells, their structure, their physiology, their metabolism, their respiration, and their inner anatomy. We journeyed, if briefly, into the world of single-celled microbes and the transformative effect of that discovery on medicine, antisepsis, and the eventual discovery of antibiotics. We next encountered cell division, the production of new cells from existing cells, mitosis, and the genesis of cells for sexual reproduction, meiosis. We witnessed the identification of the four phases of cell division: G1, S, G2, M, the characterization of its crucial regulators, cyclins and CDK proteins, and the coordinated yin-yang dance of their functions. We discovered how our understanding of cell division, its transforming cancer medicine and in vitro fertilization, IVF, and how reproductive technologies, coupled with cell biology, have forced us to enter the ethically unfamiliar landscape of interventions on human embryos. But thus far, we have dealt with cells in isolation, the single-celled microbe invading the body and precipitating infections, the dividing zygote floating alone in the petri dish like a lone planet, the egg and sperm in separate vials spirited between hospitals in a taxi across Manhattan, the retinal ganglion cell rescued from degeneration by gene therapy. The purpose of a cell in a multicellular organism, though, is not to be alone or to live alone. It is to serve the needs of the organism. It has to function as part of an ecosystem. It must be an integral part of the sum. The cell is a nexus, Maureen O'Malley and Stefan Müller-Wille wrote in 2010. Every cell lives and functions in an apparently inexhaustible potential to be found in such connective relationships. It is to these connective relationships between cells and cells, between cells and organs, and between cells and organisms that we shall now turn. I spend most of my Mondays with blood. I am a hematologist by training. I study blood and treat blood diseases, including cancers and precancers of white blood cells. On Monday, I arrive much earlier than my patients when the morning light is still aslant across the black slate of the lab benches. I close the shutters and peer through the microscope at blood smears. A droplet of blood has been spread across a glass slide to make a film of single cells, each stained with special dyes. The slides are like previews of books or movie trailers. The cells will begin to reveal the stories of the patients even before I see them in person. I sit by the microscope in the darkened room, a notepad by my side, and whisper to myself as I go through the slides. It's an old habit. A passerby might well consider me unhinged. Each time I examine a slide, I mumble out the method that my hematology professor in medical school, a tall man with a perpetually leaking pen in his pocket, taught me. Divide the main cellular components of blood. Red cell, white cell, platelet. Examine each cell type separately. Write what you observe about each type. Move methodically. Number, color, morphology, shape, size. It is, by far, the favorite time of my day at work. Number, color, morphology, shape, size. I move methodically. I love looking at cells in the way that a gardener loves looking at plants. Not just the whole, but also the parts within the parts. The leaves, the fronds, the precise smell of loam around a fern, the way the woodpecker has bored into the high branches of a tree. Blood speaks to me, but only if I pay attention. Greta B. was a middle-aged woman who had been diagnosed with anemia. Her doctor suspected that it stemmed from menstrual bleeding and prescribed iron supplements, but the anemia would not remit. Merely walking a few steps left her short of breath. When she vacationed in the Sierra Nevada mountains, 6,000 feet above sea level, she could hardly breathe. Her doctors increased Greta's iron pills, but to no avail. Greta's illness, it turned out, was more mysterious than her doctors had initially suspected. If you looked at the blood counts, this wasn't a simple anemia. Yes, her red blood count was lower than normal, as would be expected, but so too were her white cells, just a smidgen below the normal limits for her age, and the platelets also fell short of the normal range, although barely so. Under the scope, Greta's blood smear revealed a more complicated story. I ran my eyes through the smear like a wild animal sensing a new landscape, pausing, sniffing, sending shivers of thought through my brain. The red cells appeared almost normal. Almost. I underlined the word. Scanning the smear, I found some strange-looking ones that carried a distinct blue dot in the middle, the remnant of a nucleus that most mature red cells do not have, as they usually expel their nuclei in the bone marrow. That nuclear remnant shouldn't be there, I whispered aloud, and noted it in my book. The white cells were the most odd-looking. Normal white cells come in two main forms, lymphocytes and leukocytes. We will return to the distinction later. In Greta's case, one type of leukocyte, termed neutrophil, was the strangest looking of all. The nuclei of normal neutrophils have 3 to 5 lobes, like an archipelago of 3 or 5 islands connected by narrow isthmuses. But some of Greta's neutrophils had only 2 nuclear lobes, perfectly round and connected by a narrow line of blue in between. They resembled a pair of 18th-century spectacles. Pince-nez cells, I wrote. Gandhi's spectacles. And at least a couple of neutrophils had large dilated nuclei with disorganized-looking chromatin, immature blood cells, or blasts, the first signs of malignant white cells. I read through my notes. The red cells and white cells, two of the main cellular components of blood, were abnormal. A bone marrow biopsy confirmed that she had myelodysplastic syndrome, a clinical syndrome in which the bone marrow does not generate normal blood. About 1 in 3 patients diagnosed with MDS progresses to leukemia, cancer of white blood cells. Greta's iron pills were discontinued and she was started on an experimental drug. Her blood counts normalized for about 6 months, but then the anemia returned and the percentage of blasts in her bone marrow began to rise again. Under normal circumstances, blast cells make up, at most, 5% of the marrow. Her blast count was several times that, indicating that the MDS was in the process of transforming to frank leukemia. At that point, her treatment options would be limited to chemotherapy to kill the leukemia, or the possibility of trying another experimental drug to keep the disease at bay. In medical school, my professors taught me how to speak the language of blood. Now, at long last, the tissue speaks back to me. In fact, blood speaks to everyone and everything. It is the central mechanism of long-distance communication, of transmission in humans. Be it hormones, nutrients, oxygen, or waste products, blood delivers and connects, talks to every organ and from one organ to the next. It even speaks to itself. Its three cellular components, red cells, white cells, and platelets in particular, engage in an elaborate system of signaling and crosstalk. Platelets band together to form a clot. A single platelet, in isolation, cannot congeal into a clot, but millions of platelets, in conjunction with proteins in the blood, collaborate to seal a bleeding site. White blood cells have the most complex system of all. They signal one another to coordinate an immune response, the healing of wounds, fighting microbes, and surveying the body for invaders as a system of cells. Blood is a network. As with MK, the young pneumonia patient with immunodeficiency, the collapse of one piece of the net can lead to the collapse of the whole net. The idea of blood as an organ of communication or transmission between organs has a long history. Around AD 150, Galen of Pergamon, the Greek surgeon to the Roman gladiators, and eventually physician to Emperor Lucius Aurelius Commodus, had proposed that normal bodies were composed of some balance of four humors: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. This humoral theory of disease predated Galen. Aristotle had written about it, and Vedic doctors often referred to the interplay of internal fluids. But Galen was among its most vociferous champions. Illness, he contended, occurred when one of the humors was off balance in a body. Pneumonia was an excess of phlegm. Jaundice, or rather hepatitis, came from yellow bile. Cancer was a disease of the accumulation of black bile, a fluid also associated with melancholia or depression. Melancholia literally means black bile, a magnificent theory that was as metaphorically seductive as it was mechanistically flawed. Of the four fluids, blood was the most familiar. It poured out of gladiatorial wounds. It was acquired easily from slaughtered animals for experimental manipulations. It was, indeed, built into the very vocabulary of common human language. It was warm, active, and red to start, Galen noticed. And then, like the victims who spilled blood, it grew blue, sluggish, and cold. Galen associated its normal function with heat, energy, and nutrition. Its redness, or rubor, was a sign of its warmth and vitality. Blood existed to distribute nutrition and heat to the organs, Galen posited. The heart, he imagined, was the body's furnace, a heat-generating smelting machine cooled by the bellows-like lungs. It was a restatement of Aristotle's idea of blood as the internal cooking oil of the body. Blood picked up the heated-up food from the heart and, like a food delivery vehicle, kept the nutrients warm until they had reached the brain, kidney, and other organs. In 1628, the English physiologist William Harvey upended this theory in his book Exercitatio Anatomica, De Motu, Cordis et Sanguinis in Animalibus. Early anatomists had proposed that the flow of blood was unidirectional, traveling from one's heart to the intestines, say, where it reached a dead end. Harvey argued that blood moved around in continuous circles, entering the heart, exiting it, and then returning to the heart again after having completed its delivery route. There were no separate conduits for heating and cooling. I began privately to think that it might rather have a certain movement, as it were, in a circle, he wrote. Blood flows through the lungs and heart and is pumped to the whole body. There it passes through pores in the flesh into the veins, through which it returns from the periphery everywhere to the center, from the smaller veins into the larger ones, finally coming to the heart again. The heart was not a furnace or a factory, or even a cooling fan for a furnace or factory. It was a pump, or rather two pumps conjoined with each other, that powered these two circuits. We will return to Harvey's work on the heart in a few chapters. But what was the purpose of the circular movement of blood? What substance was blood carrying in these restless, continuous circles around the body? Cells, of course, among other things. Red blood cells. Leeuwenhoek had seen them floating in blood. On August 14, 1675, he wrote, "Those sanguineous globules, red blood cells, in a healthy body, must be very flexible and pliant if they are to pass through the small capillary veins and arteries, and that, in their passage, they change into an oval figure, reassuming their roundness when they come into a larger room." It was a prescient idea that blood cells, as they move through thin bored capillaries, would deform their structures and then resume their disc-like roundness. Marcello Malpighi, the 17th-century Italian anatomist, had also seen these red globules. So had the Dutch physician-scientist Jan Swammerdam, who had pulled a drop of freshly ingested human blood out of a louse's stomach in 1658. In the 1770s, a British anatomist and physiologist named William Hewson studied the shape of red cells more carefully. They weren't round globules, he concluded, but disc-shaped, with an indentation in the middle, like a circular pillow that has just been punched. The cells were so abundant that they must have a function, Hewson surmised. But the mystery of what red blood cells carried, why the circles circulated so relentlessly, and why they squeezed their way so purposefully through tiny capillaries, distorting their very shape, remained unsolved. In 1840, Friedrich Hünefeld, a German physiologist, found a protein in the red blood cells of earthworms. Hünefeld was surprised by the protein's abundance. More than 90% of a red cell's dry weight is composed of just one protein, but he did not understand its function. The name given to the protein, hemoglobin, was just a bland restatement of its cellular location, a glob in blood. By the late 1880s, however, physiologists had begun to understand the importance of the glob. They noted that hemoglobin carried iron, and the iron in turn bound oxygen, the molecule responsible for cellular respiration. The observations made by Harvey, Swammerdam, Hünefeld, and Leeuwenhoek began to crystallize into a theory. The principal purpose of the red blood cell was to ferry oxygen, bound to hemoglobin, to tissues and all the body's organs. Red cells pick up oxygen in the lungs, then are routed to the heart, which propels them on their voyage through the arteries to the rest of the body. But why does one need a cell to transport oxygen? Why not float hemoglobin as a free protein in the plasma and let it move in the body? It's a conundrum that still remains unsolved and has to do with the structure of hemoglobin. A fascinating subject we will return to late in this audiobook. In addition to cells, plasma, the fluid component of blood, carries other materials crucial to human physiology: carbon dioxide, hormones, metabolites, waste products, nutrients, clotting factors, and chemical signals. One astonishing feature of the body's circulation is that, like all circles, it is recursive. Red cells carry oxygen to all body parts and, in due course, to the muscles of the heart, the very organ that is responsible for propelling blood throughout the body. The heart draws oxygen from red cells to pump, thereby sending the red cells in another roundabout mission to bring them more oxygen to pump, and so forth, in endless circles. In short, circulation depends on the heart, whose essential function depends on, well, circulation. The transmission of every substance in the body, and, by extension, the operation of every organ, then, depends on the most restless of all our cells. But there is yet another kind of transmission that blood is capable of. It can be transferred from one human to another. Blood transfusion, the first modern form of cellular therapy, would lay the basis for surgery, for treating anemia, for cancer chemotherapy, for trauma medicine, for bone marrow transplantation, for the safety of childbirth, and the future of immunology. Blood transfusion didn't have a particularly propitious origin. Early experiments to transfuse blood into humans range from the macabre to the mad. In 1667, Jean-Baptiste Denis, a personal physician to King Louis XIV of France, bled a young boy multiple times with leeches and then attempted to transfuse sheep's blood into him. Miraculously, the boy survived, likely because the amount of blood transfused was minimal and there was no allergic response. Later that year, Denis tried to transfuse animal blood into Antoine Morat, a man with a psychiatric disorder. The blood of a calf, an animal known for its sober disposition, was chosen in the belief that it might calm the overheated madness in Morat, yet again reinforcing Galen's notion of blood as one of the carriers of the psyche. Three transfusions later, unfortunately, Morat was not just preternaturally calm, he was dead, his body and face bloated by an allergic reaction. His wife tried to sue Denis for murder, and the doctor narrowly escaped imprisonment. He stopped practicing medicine. The episode set off a minor furor in France, and experiments with animal-to-human transfusions were banned. Other research into transfusing blood continued throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. Scientists noted that transfusion between identical twin animals was accepted, while transfusions between siblings, including fraternal, non-identical twins, were rejected, suggesting that some genetic compatibility was required in order for transfusion to succeed. But the nature of that compatibility remained a mystery. In 1900, an Austrian scientist named Karl Landsteiner began to tackle the challenge of human blood transfusion more systematically. Where there had been madness before him, sheep and calf blood forced into leeched boys or psychically disturbed men, Landsteiner was all about method. Blood was a liquid organ. It moved freely around the body. Why couldn't it be moved just as freely from one human body to another? Landsteiner mixed blood from one individual, call him A, and serum from another, B, and watched the two react in test tubes and on glass slides. Serum differs from plasma. It is the fluid that's left over after blood has been clotted. It contains proteins, including antibodies, but no cells. Serum from A mixed with blood from A obviously yielded no reaction, a sign of compatibility. The result was exactly the same as if the blood cells had been mixed with their own serum, Landsteiner noted. The mixture melded together and remained liquid. But on other occasions, when blood from patient A was mixed with serum from patient B, the combination formed tiny, semi-solid clumps. My hematology professor described them as seeds in strawberry juice. The incompatibility could not lie in A's cells rejecting B's cells. Serum, remember, has no cells. Rather, it must be a protein, later found to be an antibody, present or absent in A's blood that was attacking B's cells, a sign of immunologic incompatibility. The antibody was later found to be reacting to a unique set of sugars found on the surface of red blood cells. By mixing and matching blood from various donors, Landsteiner eventually found that he could classify the blood from humans into four groups: A, B, AB, and O. Landsteiner initially found only three blood groups that he denoted A, B, and C, but in his papers, published in 1936, he had already distinguished four independent blood groups, now denoted A, B, AB, and O. The groups indicated transfusion compatibility. Humans with the A blood group could accept blood only from others with the A blood group, and the O group. Those with B could accept blood only from others with B and the O group. The O group was the strangest. O blood did not react with either A or B. Humans in this group could donate blood to someone with either type, but they could not accept blood from anyone but fellow O's. A fourth and final major blood group, AB, was discovered soon after. These individuals could receive blood from all donors, but could donate only to other AB group humans. In common parlance, the four groups came to be known as A, B, O, universal donors, and AB, universal acceptors. In a single table, reproduced in his collected papers and later published in 1936, Landsteiner delineated the four basic blood groups and laid the basis for blood transfusion. It was an advance of such medical and biological significance that that one table alone would be sufficient to award Landsteiner the 1930 Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine. In time, the blood group system would undergo further refinement. Other factors were added, such as Rh positive, denoting the presence of an inherited protein called rhesus factor on the surface of red blood cells, and Rh negative, indicating a lack of Rh factor, for determining compatibility within each group, A positive, B negative, AB negative, and so forth. The discovery of blood compatibility transformed the field of blood transfusion. In 1907, at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York, Dr. Reuben Ottenberg began to use Landsteiner's reaction of compatibility to perform the first safe transfusions between humans. By matching blood between donors and recipients before the transfusion, Ottenberg demonstrated that blood could be safely transferred between mutually compatible humans. Transfusion slowly turned into a systematic and safe science. In 1913, after more than a half decade's experience with matching blood, Ottenberg wrote, "Accidents following transfusion have been sufficiently frequent to make many medical men hesitate to advise transfusion, except in desperate cases. But since we began making observations on this question in 1908, such accidents could be prevented by careful preliminary tests. Our observations on over 125 cases have confirmed this view, and we believe that untoward symptoms can be prevented with absolute certainty." But even so, early blood transfusions were still extraordinarily cumbersome. Timing was crucial. It was like a hectic relay race with a blood-filled syringe as the moving baton. One technician would draw pints of blood repeatedly through a needle inserted in the donor's arm. Another would rush the crimson liquid across the room as fast as she could, and a third would inject the blood into the recipient's arm. Or a surgeon might create a physical link between the donor's artery and the recipient's vein, binding them, literally, by blood so that the fluid could flow directly from the donor's circulation to the recipient's without touching free air. But without such interventions, the liquid form of blood was fleetingly evanescent outside the body. Left alone, even for a few extra minutes, it would coagulate, turning it from a life-saving fluid to an unusable clog of gel. A few final technological advances were necessary to make blood transfusions amenable to use in the field setting. The addition of a simple salt found in lime juice, sodium citrate, kept blood from coagulating, prolonging its storage. In 1914, the year the Great War ignited, an Argentinian doctor, Luisa Gote, transfused citrated blood from one person to another, a glorious instance of technology preempting its need. This great stride forward in the technique of blood transfusion coincided so nearly with the beginning of the war, British surgeon Geoffrey Keynes wrote in 1922, that it seemed almost as if foreknowledge of the necessity for it in treating war wounds had stimulated research. Another advance, refrigeration, added to the longevity of stored blood. Further innovations involved the use of paraffin-coated storage bags and the addition of simple sugar, dextrose, to keep the blood from spoiling. The number of transfusions soared in hospitals across the world. In 1923, there were 123 transfusions at Mount Sinai Hospital. By 1953, there were more than 3,000 annually. The real trial for blood transfusion, its field test, as it were, was on the blood-soaked battlefields of World Wars I and II. Shelling tore off limbs, internal wounds hemorrhaged, arteries severed by bullets could bleed out in a matter of minutes. By 1917, when the United States joined the Allies in the fight against Germany and the other Central Powers, two military medical specialists, Major Bruce Robertson and Captain Oswald Robertson, had pioneered transfusions for acute blood loss and shock. Plasma II was used extensively to revive seriously wounded soldiers. Though a short-term solution for blood loss, it could be stored more easily and required no typing and matching. The two Robertsons were unrelated. Oswald, serving in the French front of the U.S. Medical Corps, began to think of blood as a mobile organ, restless not just inside humans or between humans, but between national borders and battlefields. He collected O-group blood from convalescing soldiers at one site, then packed sterile 2-liter glass bottles containing citrated dextrose-supplemented blood in ammunition boxes filled with sawdust and ice, and shipped them to the battlefield for use. In effect, Captain Oswald had established one of the first blood banks. A more formal bank would be set up in Leningrad in 1932. Gratitude poured in. "On the 13th June, you took my leg off above the knee," one soldier wrote to Major Bruce Robertson in 1917, "and until I received blood from someone else, you considered the betting about 3-1 on my pegging out. Can you find time to let me know the name and address of the man who gave me blood? I should much like to write to him." By the time World War II broke out just 2 decades later, banking, matching, and transfusion had become common practices in the field. Compared to the First World War, the mortality rate of wounded soldiers who reached a field hospital nearly halved, due partly to blood transfusions. In the early 1940s, the United States, aided by the American Red Cross, launched a nationwide program for blood donation and banking. By the end of the war, the Red Cross had collected 13 million units of blood, and within a matter of years, the U.S. blood system had 1,500 hospital-based blood banks. There were 46 community donation centers and 31 regional centers to donate blood. As one writer put it in a 1965 issue of the journal Annals of Internal Medicine, "War has never lavished gifts on humanity. An exception may be made for the impetus and popularization of the use of blood and plasma, attributable to the Spanish Civil War, World War II, and the Korean conflict. Perhaps more than any other intervention, transfusion and banking, cellular therapy stands as the most significant medical legacy of the war." It is virtually impossible to envision the development of modern surgery, safe childbirth, or cancer chemotherapy without the invention of blood transfusion. In the late 1990s, I resuscitated a man with liver failure who had one of the most severe forms of hemorrhage that I have ever witnessed. He was a 60-something man from South Boston with liver cirrhosis caused by something that the consultant hepatologists had never quite been able to pinpoint. A former restaurateur, he drank alcohol but insisted that the amount was well below the levels that would make his liver fail. There was no chronic viral infection. Some genetic predisposition must have compounded the alcohol use and caused the chronic cellular inflammation, eventually resulting in his burned-out, shrunken liver. His eyes were yellow from jaundice, and the level of albumin, a protein synthesized in his blood, was dangerously low. His blood failed to clot normally, again a sign of a diseased liver, for the organ produces some of the factors required for blood to clot. Now he was in the hospital, awaiting a liver transplant. But overall, he was generally fine and had been placed on a routine monitor. At first, the evening was uneventful, but then the patient felt a wave of nausea and his blood pressure dropped. A little monitor beeped. The blood pressure cuff read and reread the numbers. Something was off. Within minutes, it was as if a spigot had opened in his guts with blood pouring out everywhere. Liver failure often causes the blood vessels in the stomach and esophagus to dilate and become brittle. Once they burst, the gush of blood can be unstoppable. Add to this the impaired clotting associated with cirrhosis, and the bleeding can spiral into a medical disaster. The nurses and doctors in the ICU tried to stop the bleeding and then urgently issued an emergency code call. I was the senior medical resident on call that night. By the time I walked into the room, it was already humming with frantic activity. The IV lines inserted into his veins were too thin. "I need a line," I commanded, surprised by the volume and confidence of my own voice. We inserted 2 new ones, but the bags of saline, dripping sluggishly, could hardly be expected to keep up with the loss of blood. By now, the man had begun to flail and lose consciousness. He spoke madly, cuss words, sitcom characters, childhood memories, and then, ominously, stopped talking altogether. I touched him. His feet felt ice cold. The blood vessels in his skin had compressed to conserve blood in his vital organs. The floor, meanwhile, was covered in white towels that had turned crimson-red. There were clots of blood drying on my clogs. My scrubs were crusty and had turned a purplish-red color. One nurse replaced the blood-soaked towels with new ones, but within a few minutes they were bright red, too. A surgical resident managed to insert a large bore line into his neck vein while I looked frantically for an IV site in the groin. "Pulse, pulse, pulse," I said to myself. The man's blood pressure, meanwhile, kept dipping, and his pulse became thready. The code team continued working in a choreographed dance that reminded me of the early days of blood transfusion. This, too, was a relay race with blood as the central baton. It seemed like hours before the bags of blood were brought up, but, in fact, the whole process took less than 10 minutes. We hung two bags. "Squeeze gently," I said, and the nurse managed to send in a bag full over a few minutes. "Squeeze hard," I said, changing my mind, as if I could speed up time. It took 11, perhaps 12, bags of blood to stabilize him. I lost count. We added a bag or two of clotting factors and platelets to help his blood clot. 2 hours later, we had managed to restore the pulse, and the bleeding had slowed down. By late evening, the bleeding had stopped. His skin warmed up, and he began to respond to commands. "Move your left hand," he did. "Shake your toes," he did. I felt a joy that I cannot describe. He awoke the next day and managed to hold a cup of ice in his hand. The lasting image I have from that night is walking down the lonely corridor of the 6th floor and ducking into the bathroom to disinfect my soaked clogs with a spray bottle and wash the dried blood off them. The leather was so deeply encrusted that it made me nauseous. It was a Macbethian moment. I could not wash off the stains. I threw the clogs in the trash and bought new ones from the hospital store the next morning. Ever since that evening, I never used the word bloodbath casually. I happen to be among the few people that has actually been bathed in blood. The Healing Cell. Platelets, clots, and a modern epidemic. Imperious Caesar, dead and turned to clay, might stop a hole to keep the cold away. Oh, that earth which kept the world in awe should patch a wall to expel the winter's flaw. William Shakespeare, Hamlet, Act 5, Scene 1. It would be too glib to say that the surgeons, or the nurses, or I, for that matter, had stopped the man's bleeding that night in Boston. We were accessories. There was a cell, or rather a fragment of a cell, that played the central role in controlling the bleed. In 1881, the Italian pathologist and microscopist Giulio Bezzaro found that human blood carried minuscule fragments of cells, tiny, shorn-up pieces barely visible but always present. For decades, hematologists had wondered about these fragmentary pieces that floated in blood. In 1865, a German microscopic anatomist named Max Schultz had described them as granular fragments. Schultz thought of them as pieces of shredded blood cells, found them in clots, and recommended that, for those who are concerned with the in-depth study of the blood of humans, the study of these granules in human blood is enthusiastically recommended. Bizzazzero recognized them as an independent component of blood. The existence of a constant blood particle, differing from red and white blood cells, has been suspected by several authors for some time, he wrote. It is astonishing that none of the previous investigators made use of the observation of circulating blood in living animals. He assigned the shards a name, piastrini, in Italian, for their flat, round, plate-like appearance. In English, they were called platelets, small plates. Bizzazzero was more than a microscopist. He was a physiologist in full. Having observed these cell fragments in the blood, he began to wonder about their function. Were they just debris, flotsam in the red ocean of blood? When he pricked the artery of a rabbit with a needle, he observed platelets accumulating at the injury site. Blood platelets, swept along by the bloodstream, are held up at the damaged spot as soon as they arrive at it, he wrote. At first, one sees only 2 to 4 to 6 platelets. Very soon, the number climbs to hundreds. Usually, some white blood cells are held up amongst them. Little by little, the volume increases, and soon the thrombus, blood clot, fills the lumen of the blood vessels and impedes the bloodstream more and more. Platelets are unusual in their biology right from their birth. In the early 1900s, the Boston hematologist James Wright developed a new stain to visualize cells in the bone marrow. Nestled within the various cell types, maturing neutrophils, slowly unfurling their early egg-shaped nuclei into many lobed ones, red cells developing in tight clusters, he found a massive cell that seemed to have defied the conventions of cell biology. Rather than possessing a single nucleus, it was a cell with more than a dozen nuclear lobes. It had been born, presumably, from a mother cell that had replicated its nuclear contents but halted the division or birth of daughter cells, preferring instead to mature and then splinter into 1,000 fragments. Indeed, as Wright followed the fate of these megakaryocytes, massive multinuclear lobe-carrying cells, he found that they broke up, like fireworks, into thousands of little shards, platelets. This early anatomical work led to a period of intense investigation into the function and physiology of these cells. As Bizzozero had observed, platelets were found to be the central component of a clot. Activated by signals from an injury, a wound, say, or a broken blood vessel, they swarmed to the wound site and began a self-perpetuating loop to plug the bleeding. It was a healing cell, or, more accurately, cell fragment. See the illustration in the attached PDF. In parallel, researchers discovered that there was a second, intersecting system in the blood to stop bleeding. This involved a cascade of proteins that float in the blood, sense injury, and also assist in congealing into a dense mesh to stabilize the platelet clot and stanch bleeding. The two systems, platelets and clot-making proteins, communicate with each other, each amplifying the effect of the other to form a stable clot. A number of genetic disorders involving the failure of platelet function and resulting in abnormalities and clotting further elucidated how a platelet senses an injury. In 1924, a Finnish hematologist, Erik von Willebrand, described the case of a 5-year-old girl from the Åland Islands in the Baltic Sea whose blood did not clot properly. By analyzing the blood of family members, several of whom had similar clotting disorders, von Willebrand discovered that they all possessed an inherited abnormality that impairs platelet function. In 1971, researchers finally apprehended the culprit. People with this disease, named after von Willebrand, were either missing or deficient in a key clotting protein called, appropriately enough, von Willebrand factor, VWF. Von Willebrand's factor circulates in blood and is also strategically located right under the cells that line blood vessels. Injury to the blood vessel exposes VWF. Platelets carry receptors that bind to VWF and thus have the capacity to sense when a wound has exposed the vessel, and they begin to gather around the site of injury. But the formation of a clot is a much more complex process. Proteins secreted by the injured cells send out further signals to summon platelets to the site of injury, amplifying their activation. And clotting factors floating in the blood use yet other sensors to detect the injury. A cascade of changes is launched. Ultimately, the cascade leads to the conversion of a protein called fibrinogen into a mesh-forming protein called fibrin. Platelets, trapped in the fibrin mesh, like sardines in a net, ultimately form a mature clot. If the vagaries of ancient human life involved plugging wounds to maintain homeostasis, the vagaries of modern life have unleashed the opposite problem: too much platelet activation. The process meant to heal wounds has become pathological. As Rudolf Virchow might have put it, cellular physiology has undergone an about-face and become cellular pathology. In 1886, William Osler, one of the founders of modern medicine, described platelet-rich clots that had formed in the valves of the heart and in the aorta, the large arch-shaped blood vessel that courses through the body. Nearly 3 decades later, in 1912, a cardiologist in Chicago described the mysterious case of a 55-year-old banker who fell like a dud. As doctors investigated the case, they found that the artery that brought blood to the patient's heart had become occluded by a clot. The condition became commonly known as a heart attack, the word attack signifying the speed and suddenness of the crisis. And so, as much as ancient humans may have desired a drug to activate platelets to heal their wounds, modern humans are in search of drugs that dampen platelet activity. Our lifestyles, lifespans, habits, and environments, fat-rich diets, lack of exercise, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and smoking in particular, have led in turn to the accumulation of plaques, inflamed, calcified, cholesterol-rich blobs that hang on the walls of the arteries like precarious mounds of debris alongside highways, accidents waiting to happen. When a plaque ruptures or breaks, it is sensed as a wound, and the ancient cascade to heal wounds is activated and released. Platelets rush in to plug that wound, except the plug, rather than sealing an injury, blocks the vital flow of blood into the heart muscle. The healing platelet now turns into a deadly platelet. The modern epidemic of heart disease, the physician-historian James LaFanu writes, started quite suddenly in the 1930s. Doctors had no difficulty in recognizing its gravity because so many of their colleagues were among its early victims, apparently healthy, middle-aged physicians who, for no obvious reason, suddenly collapsed and died. This new disease needed a name. The cause, it seemed, was a clot of blood in the arteries of the heart which had been narrowed by a porridge-like substance made up of a fibrous material and a type of fat called cholesterol. If you choose to read obituaries in local newspapers from the 50s and 60s, an admittedly morbid preoccupation, you can witness the modern epidemic being born. Newspaper obituaries brimmed with the names of men and women who had experienced sudden chest pain, followed by collapse and death. Elmer Sweet, Mendocino, California, superintendent, 53 years old in 1950. John Adams, a Pine City, Minnesota tinsmith, 77 years old in 1952. Gordon Mitchell, supervisor of a spinning mill, 40 years old in 1962. Lloyd Ray Luxinger, 61 years old in 1963. And so forth, day upon day. As the death toll from heart attacks mounted, pharmacologists shifted their attention to finding drugs that blocked the cascade of clotting. The most prominent among these was aspirin. Its active ingredient, salicylic acid, originally found in willow extract, had been used by the ancient Greeks, Sumerians, Indians, and Egyptians to control inflammation, pain, and fever. In 1897, a young chemist named Felix Hoffmann, working for the German pharmaceutical company Bayer, found a way to synthesize a chemical variant of salicylic acid. The medicine was called aspirin, or ASA, short for acetyl salicylic acid. The name was drawn from the A in acetyl, and spur from Spirea elmaria, the plant from which salicylic acid was extracted. Hoffmann's synthesis of aspirin was a marvel of chemistry, but the pathway from molecule to medicine was tortuous. A senior executive at Bayer, Friedrich Dresser, suspicious of aspirin, almost stopped production, claiming that the drug had an enfeebling effect on the heart. He preferred concentrating on the development of another drug, heroin, as a cough syrup and pain reliever. But Hoffmann persisted obstreperously with the production of aspirin, pushing the Bayer executives to the brink of firing him. Eventually, the tablets were made and marketed to the public. Ironically, to satisfy Dresser's concerns, the medicine, initially sold to relieve aches, pains, and fevers, had to carry the label "Does not affect the heart" on their packaging. In the 1940s and 1950s, Lawrence Craven, a suburban general practitioner in California, began giving patients aspirin to prevent heart attacks. Craven experimented on himself, increasing the dose of aspirin to 12 tablets, far above the recommended dose, until his nose began to bleed spontaneously and profusely. Having tamped down his bleeding with napkins and now convinced that aspirin was a potent anti-clotting agent, Craven treated nearly 8,000 patients with the drug. He noted that their rates of heart attacks decreased markedly. But Craven wasn't a traditional physician-scientist. He had no control group of untreated patients to compare to those that he had treated with aspirin. His study was dismissed for decades until, in the 70s and 80s, massive randomized trials proved that aspirin was indeed among the most effective therapies to prevent and treat a heart attack in progress. In the 1960s, deeper investigations into the biology of platelets revealed how aspirin works to prevent clots. Platelets, in concert with some other cells, produce chemicals to signal injury and get activated. Aspirin, at low doses, blocks the key enzyme that produces these injury-sensing chemicals, thereby decreasing platelet activation and subsequent clots. As a prevention mechanism for heart attacks, aspirin may well rank among the most important medicines of the past century. A heart attack, or myocardial infarction, occurs when a plaque in one of the coronary arteries ruptures and incites a clot. In the 1990s, I was a trainee at an internal medicine clinic run by a balding octogenarian in polished wingtips and with a refined, patrician air. He told me of a time during his own medical training when the only treatment for a heart attack was bed rest, oxygen, and sedation with morphine delivered through a glass syringe. It was a long way from the current diagnostic tests and therapies. The mad rush to the hospital, every minute wasted is a minute's worth of heart muscle dying, causing irreparable damage. An electrocardiogram, ECG, to measure the heart's electrical activity, conducted in the ambulance and then transmitted digitally to the hospital. Aspirin, oxygen, and the frantic race to get the patient to a cardiac catheterization lab, where the patient might be administered an intravenous drug known as a thrombolytic, which can dissolve a blood clot rapidly, or undergo a procedure to open the clotted artery using an inflatable balloon-shaped device. My preceptor claimed he could diagnose coronary artery disease by physical examination alone. First, he would make a mental list of the patient's risk factors, some of them avoidable, some not. Obesity, high levels of a particular kind of cholesterol, chronic tobacco use, hypertension, and/or a family history of coronary disease, assigning each point in a calculus that he kept to himself. He would place his stethoscope against the person's neck and listen for bruise, gurgling sounds that might indicate plaque buildup in the carotid arteries that course through the neck and up to the brain. Fatty gunk in one artery typically indicated gunk in another, and he would carefully note any history of chest pain, or even the slightest tingle when the patient walked or ran. With the grandiosity of a magician, he would then declare that the patient had, or did not have, coronary disease before sending him or her off for confirmatory tests. He was usually right. With a little bit of the same grandiosity, he called the coronary arteries that supply blood to the heart the rivers of life. Like a growing collection of trash and silt on the edge of a river, coronary plaque usually builds up over decades, bulging out toward the center of the hollow vessel and slowing down blood flow, although never obstructing it entirely. Plaque contains deposits of cholesterol, inflamed immune cells, and calcium, among other components. The artery's opening, lumen, is narrowed, and the backed-up traffic manifests in the intermittent searing chest pain called angina pectoris, as the heart muscle strains to get enough oxygen-laden blood to meet its demands. But angina can portend a much more acute crisis. One day the debris might rupture, spilling into the center of the river. Platelets, the body's injury detectives, rush into the blown-open injury site to plug it up. What was designed to be a physiological response to a wound becomes the pathological response to a plaque. The slowed-down traffic in the river now turns into a standstill jam, a heart attack. Over the years, pharmacologists have discovered a gamut of drugs and procedures to prevent or treat heart attacks. There's aspirin, of course, which prevents platelets from forming clots. There are clot-dissolving drugs that break up an active clot, and platelet-inhibiting drugs that ensure that the platelets don't get activated. And in the realm of prevention, there's Lipitor, one of the many drugs that reduce the level of a particular form of cholesterol carried in the blood in blob-like particles called LDL. Drugs like Lipitor decrease the blood levels of LDL, and that, in turn, prevents the buildup of cholesterol-rich lumps of trash to clog our arteries. But these drugs need to be taken every day for life. Recently, a newly launched biotech company in Boston, Verve Therapeutics, has proposed an audacious strategy for reducing blood levels of LDL cholesterol. Its founder, geneticist and cardiologist Sekh Katharasan, trained at Massachusetts General Hospital just a few years ahead of me. MGH was an each-one-do-one-teach-one hospital. The most experienced doctors taught the senior residents, who in turn taught their juniors and the interns. It was from Sake, a senior resident, when I was an intern, that I learned how to snake an intravenous line into the jugular vein of a man writhing in the ICU, or to insert a catheter through the neck veins into the ventricle of a woman's heart to precisely measure the pressures in it. Years later, I would discover that Sake's interest in heart disease was deeply personal. His brother, then in his 40s, had returned from a run and collapsed and died from a heart attack. Over the next decades, Sake's pathbreaking work would identify scores of genes that, when inherited in an altered form, increased the risk of heart attacks. Many of the crucial proteins that enable the formation, trafficking, and circulation of so-called bad cholesterol are synthesized in the liver. Recall the gene editing technologies used by He Jiankui to alter genes in human embryos, in essence, rewriting the genetic script of human cells. Neither Sake nor Verve has any interest or desire to change genes in human embryos. Rather, they hope to use gene editing technologies to inactivate the genes that encode for these cholesterol-related proteins in human liver cells, and that too without removing the liver from the body. Scientists at Verve have devised ways to insert catheters into the arteries leading to the liver. The dexterity that Sake learned from decades of practice in cardiology helped. These catheters will deliver gene-editing enzymes loaded inside tiny nanoparticles to the organ. Once these particles offload their cargoes inside the liver cells, the gene-editing enzymes will change the scripts of genes that aid and abet cholesterol metabolism, thereby drastically decreasing the amount of circulating cholesterol in the blood, in essence, activating the LDL metabolizing pathways. It's a one-and-done infusion. Once the genes have been altered, they are altered for life. If successful, Verve's gene therapy would transform you into a human with permanently lowered cholesterol level, permanently protected from coronary artery disease, permanently safe from myocardial infarction. It would be the ultimate feat of cellular re-engineering for heart disease. The river of life, to use my preceptor's favored phrase, would be cleansed forever.